The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Jason Freeman, and I'm honored to be here this evening to introduce Clark DeLeon. Benjamin Franklin, the Eagles, cheesesteaks, Clark DeLeon. Called Philadelphia's favorite columnist, Clark DeLeon has been a decades-long fixture of local journalism and culture and humor. His column, The Scene, ran in the Philadelphia Inquirer for more than 20 years, and was a go-to for slice-of-life vignettes and street-level epiphanies about the city he loves. A longtime commentator on local news stations and teacher at Montgomery County Community College, DeLeon returned to print journalism in 2012 with a column entitled, A Thousand Heartfelt Reasons to Love Philadelphia. A sage of Pennsylvania, he is also the author of the Curiosities series, a guide to the offbeat people, fantastical attractions, and other fascinating effluvia that make the Keystone State so special. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Clark DeLeon.
Love this book. Actually, the name of the column that I now write in the Inquirer is called Clark's Park. They made me pluralize it. I live right off of Clark Park in West Philadelphia. And when I was happily invited back to the Inquirer, they asked me, what do you want to call it? I said, Clark Park. And they said, well, let's call it Clark's Park. And then I thought, well, they're going to let me write anything I want. Chances are, no, that's not the way it works out. Anyway, thank you so much for coming tonight. I'll tell you a little bit about Pennsylvania Curiosities, because as much as I love Philadelphia, I've grown to love Pennsylvania and understand it a lot more than I ever did. It's as rich a state as you're going to find in America, and the things we take for granted, for instance. And this occurred to me in my core, and let me set up the background if you aren't familiar with the books. This is a fourth edition. It started when I was invited to write this book, and then my daughter, Molly, who was then in fifth grade, somebody had to take care of her. So she ended up coming with me on our trips around the state. And I used her as a character throughout. So she went from fifth grade to Temple University. She's 23 years old now. And it's funny, she was as disinterested in the whole thing as when she was 23 as she was when she was in fifth grade. But she provided a lot of comic relief to things. But if you take in the state of Pennsylvania, 30 miles, let's say, from the border, the southern boundary, which, of course, is the Mason-Dixon line, 30 miles north of that, go across the state, and just about every major event in the United States, current and past, has happened there. From the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, the Battle of Gettysburg, the French and Indian War, which was another discovery, was started by George Washington. When he was 24 years old, he attacked a French, not a garrison, but they were on a patrol, and he ended up, it was considered a murder, actually, he executed the French guy who was the brother of the head of Fort Pitt, or rather Fort Duquesne in Pittsburgh. So they send out a party to fight George Washington. And he set up a battle, or a lager, if you will, a little wooden retreat in Somerset County in a place called Fort Necessity. And this was the only time George Washington ever signed a surrender to the French, because they were just outgunned. It was raining. They had no all their powder was wet. So he was able to surrender, and they were honorable. They sent him home with their guns. That started what is called the French and Indian War in America, but in Europe it's called the Seven Years' War. So this is, you know, George Washington, forget about the cherry tree. He started some trouble back then. So this was like from the western side of Pennsylvania. And then let's consider Pittsburgh as like the Industrial Revolution there. So then let's consider Flight 93 crashing in Somerset County. And, you know, how did it choose this spot? You know, we know how, but, you know, you got New York, you got Washington, but this little town of Shanksville is known now as this memorable place where America fought back for the first time in the war on terror. And if you remember when that happened, my first instinct was, A, Americans shot them down. It was the Air Force that shot down the airliner. Then the next was, it was the passengers who fought back, which is, ends up being the actual event. So I highly recommend, it's in the book, this new edition, the new Flight 93 Memorial. It's deeply spiritual. You can't help but really feel it and seeing where the plane... And in the book, I describe, my wife and I went out to Somerset, which is the county seat of Somerset County, and Shanksville's near there. And we go into a restaurant, and I'm on a mission to write about this Flight 93. So we sit down. The tables were all taken. So we sat at the bar and ordered a meal there. And there was a guy next to us, next to me, to my left, a young fella, he was 18 years old, and his father, it turns out. So I told him what we were doing, or why I was there, and he said, "Yeah, I was a first responder. He was working. He was a volunteer fireman for the Berlin, a town near their fire department." So I'm thinking, "Oh my God, this is talk about luck, you know." So as I'm talking to this guy, a woman comes up to us or me. She says, "I heard you talking about Flight 93." And I said, "Yeah, I'm here. I'm writing a book, and I want to include this." She said, "My mother was the oldest passenger to die on that flight." And it's like, again, I'm going, like, are people putting me on? Because this doesn't happen to reporters where you have this kind of thing drop in your lap. So I took her at her word. I found out later she was what she said she was. But there was that moment when I said, "Your mother died here, and this is a first responder." And she just went over and hugged him. And it was like, wow, that was a moment. And I've had a lot of those in these Pennsylvania experiences, because I'm just a stranger in town, you know. I'm looking for, and it's funny too, when you're looking for the weird thing, a weird statue. Let's say there's one in Frackville, which is a coal town, and it shows what I call like a Norman Bates hotel mother. She's scary, and she's got this little Norman Bates child who looks about 40 years old leaning against her, and she's holding, the child's a girl child, but it looks like a 40-year-old man, and he's holding a decapitated doll, which, you know, just finishes off the whole effect. And it turns out that the people in the hotel, or rather the restaurant there, for good luck, they'll throw a quarter into the hole in the neck of the decapitated doll. Pretty sick stuff, but... also in Mahanoy City, it's funny, we in Pennsylvania, Philadelphia certainly, there's that whole Pennsylvania that we really don't know much about, which is coal country and what they lived through and the Molly Maguires. So in Mahanoy City, which is right in the heart of coal country, there's a memorial to, it's called the Hooded Man, and it shows a guy about to be hung. You don't see the noose, but you see he's got a bag, or, you know, a hood over his head. His hands are tied behind his back. His feet are tied together. Really well done sculpture. But it's right on the main street. And it's kind of like, wow. I can't, well, the 30th Street Memorial with the angel holding the soldier, that's kind of has that kind of an effect. So they did, they put a wall, like a cover, like a brick wall, so you have to walk in to see it. It's not like you're driving by and you see a guy about to be executed. But the whole story of the Molly Maguires, I found out, of course, in the research. As you know, the Molly Maguires was an Irish underground, sort of a a terrorist group that was actually a union, or they wanted to be a union, and they were responsible for some violence and blowing up mines and stuff like that. But then they were more, they received the violent end by the private police force owned by the owner of the Reading Railroad. Reading Railroad was a big coal, that was their big money coming in, a guy named Gowan, who actually was able to hire police, hire a district attorney, convicted all these guys. There were like a dozen of them hung in Mock Chunk, which is now Jim Thorpe, Pennsylvania, and in Pottsville, which is still Pottsville, but it's where the Yingling Brewery is. But this whole idea of the story behind that, what I was surprised by was the people in Mahanoy City, they're still kind of quiet about it. They don't quite, they're not forthcoming in the stories, you know, which you would think by now it's history. It's, that history is a little still close to the vest. It's there's a lot of shame involved and also a lot of religious sort of persecution or, you know, mistrust. So Pennsylvania Curiosities, the notion of it, like on the cover of the book, it says, quirky characters, roadside oddities, and other offbeat stuff. Well, there's that in this book, but what I really like about the book is the more interesting historical context of things like, did you know that Pennsylvania and Connecticut fought a series of wars called the Yankee-Pennamite Wars? The Yankees, of course, were the Connecticut guys, and the Pennamites were the Pens. There were three of them fought over from 1773, roughly, till roughly 1800. They took time off for the Revolutionary War, and they fought together for that. But then, you know this, have you seen the movie The Last of the Mohicans? And that scene where the Indians come from both sides and kill everybody. That happened in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. The British, who were the Indian allies, if you will, they lured the Americans out of their fort. And actually, it was called 40 Fort. That's the name of a town in Pennsylvania. They lured them out, and this was the... English, I'm sorry, I'm telling you a Revolutionary War story, but about Wyoming. But this was the Connecticut people who got butchered. What happened was they lured them out of the fort, they went up to meet them, then all of a sudden the Indians came on either side and murdered everybody. Then they went into the fort and they killed women, children. It was awful. And out of this came a poem by a famous Scottish poet named, the poem's name was Gertrude of Wyoming. And it became famous throughout America, throughout the world. And that's where the state of Wyoming got its name, from Wyoming, Pennsylvania, because it kind of represented the treachery of the English and the Indians. You know, it was sort of surrounded, like Wyoming was, what, 1897, something like that? But that's why they chose the name. Why would they choose a Philadelphia, or rather a Pennsylvania, not even a county, then it was an area. But that was Wyoming. That's where all the battles of the Yankee-Pennamite Wars were fought. Because the King of England, different king, the same Charles II gave William Penn the land that we call Pennsylvania. Well, his predecessor had given Connecticut land, the same coordinates. So the Connecticut people come in thinking this is our land. And that's what happened. And that's the other thing. We, Pennsylvania, so much of the land that we have today was under dispute. Virginia claimed half of western Pennsylvania. Maryland claimed up to, including just below Philadelphia, would have been Maryland. That's what happened with Jeremiah Dixon. The Mason-Dixon line was basically a compromise to find the actual boundary of Pennsylvania and Maryland. So all these stories from the past I find endlessly interesting, and the roadside oddities are part of it too. There's a statue in Ashland, Pennsylvania. That's another coal town. not far from Centralia, which is the real, you know, still on fire. And what an eerie place that is, you know. Like, I've been there, like, over the years visiting it. You can't see the fire anymore. It's not, like, smoking or anything. But now the fire is working its way toward Mount Carmel, which is the next town a few miles away. So in our lifetime, we're going to hear about Mount Carmel being on fire, too. And this thing, the fire in Centralia started, Jack Kennedy was president. It was like on Labor Day 1962, and it was a dump fire. They used to throw trash into these mine shafts, and, you know, it's like a compost of the actual heat. So it ignited. Next thing you know, they're on fire, and it's been burning all that. It's just a crazy Pennsylvania story. But Ashland, which is not far away, is they had this famous statue of Whistler's mother. Not Conversation in Black and White. What's the name of the it's famous Whistler's mother, but the painting is called something in Black and White. And it's located on not a mountaintop, but it should be, because it's the most, not depressing, but scary. It's not mom you want to meet. This is a mom that you worship from afar. She's way up high on a chair, and she's, you know, not looking at you. She's like looking sideways, wondering, when's my son going to show up? You know, this kind of thing. And it says on the mother is the most wonderful thing in life, something like that. But it's the most severe and depressing kind of rendering of mom, I think. And this was built during the Depression, you know, and it's like, but this is this town's statement of mother, why we love mom. And this is a mom that you wouldn't even expect chocolate chip cookies from, or, you know, anything. She was a very severe mom, and again, had that Norman Bates quality of Norman, you know, somewhere around here. But, now, the covers of the book, this is it. I should have brought the third edition, the last one, because I had from Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania. Punxsutawney, Phil, of course, the groundhog. Well, that's an industry out there. And they've got like 50 statues of Punxsutawney Phil in various artistic renderings of like the $1 Phil outside a bank. You know, it's all green with the cash on it. And there's, you know, other representations of miners and so forth. So outside of what they call the Groundhog Zoo, which is the library of Punxsutawney, there's another Phil. So I take this picture, and it just so happens that my daughter Molly is walking away, you know, toward the camera. And she's a love. This is when she's like 17. She's gorgeous. And it was like, oh, wow, they're going to put that on the cover. This is what they like that picture. So when the book came out, there's Punxsutawney Phil, there's a Groundhog Zoo, and there's no Molly. They airbrushed her out, which was, you know, she's all excited waiting for this, you know, to show her friends. And she actually laughed when I told her, they don't like people in their covers. So this is Mr. Rogers on the current edition of Pennsylvania Courier. I had Rocky, the statue of Rocky, on this one, or the third edition. This is an awful statue. I don't know why they chose it, because you really can't tell it's Mr. Rogers. It's he looks like a mud monster from the river, kind of. And this is what Jimmy Kimmel actually called it. They took the nicest man in the world and made him look like a mud monster when the statue came out. But then this one down here, I don't know, you can't see it, but it's a shoe. It's a big house, like the little old lady lived in a shoe. This is outside of York, Pennsylvania. And the story is one of those great American. Here was a guy who sold shoes. He had about maybe 10 shoe stores. And he builds a house that looks like a shoe. And he promotes it. And he gives it away as a honeymoon place for newlyweds. And things like this. And it's still there. You know, this is like Lucy the Elephant, except in York. These are all the kinds of things that I keep looking for. And discover by degrees. And I can't believe some of the things I found out that I didn't know from the, you know, first edition. For instance, you know where Jessup, Pennsylvania is? Ever hear of Jessup? It's about 7 miles outside of Scranton. For more than 100 years in Jessup, Pennsylvania, which was settled by these Italians who came from this little town of Gubbio in Italy to be coal miners in Pennsylvania. And they brought with them a tradition, which is called the Racing of the Saints. And they had the Saint Gubbio, who is one of the saints, Saint George and Saint Anthony. These are the others. And they had this big race through town with these big platform, 12-foot-high things that require like 10 men to carry and run. And they come right down the middle of town. And it's done in Italy. They've been doing it for hundreds of years. And this is, I've seen it. It's like this mountainous town. I mean, you could get killed doing this thing. It's like the running of the bulls. And literally these guys look like the running of the bulls. They had those kind of sashes and, you know, very colorful pantaloons, white pants and sashes around their waist. And every year they do this. It's, if you remember this, it's the weekend before Memorial Day. And it's always the Saturday. And it gets thousands of people. I never heard of that. Has anyone heard of that? I was amazed by that. Me looking for stories like this, I had never heard it. And this is the fourth edition. So I was delighted to find it. But as I was saying about that 30-mile stretch of across Pennsylvania, think of it as, you know, really, this is where the crucible of American history was Gettysburg. That happened right there. The Constitution, the Declaration, Benjamin Franklin, everything else. And then moving across, there's other things you just discover. In fact, I was reading the Abraham Lincoln, the Rivals, what's it called? The Team of Rivals. And just today, literally, I was reading about when they passed the 13th Amendment. And it was a guy, the sort of swing vote was a guy from Somerset, a Democrat from Somerset, Pennsylvania, who basically made a speech saying, if I change my mind, I changed my mind. And if I have to go down in history as, you know, being pilloried for this, I go into my grave happy. So I had never heard of this guy, whose name I can't recall right now. But that would be something I would look at and say maybe that could be in the next edition. But there's so much in Pennsylvania that is, do you know what Pennsylvania is named for? It's not William Penn. His father, yeah. It was the king insisted that the land be, or that this, Penn wanted to call it Sylvania, which is woodlands, and the king insisted he'd call it Pennsylvania because for his father, because the father had lent the king money when 16,000 pounds. When the king, or when the father died, the son gets this inheritance, and he was smart enough to ask the king for land in North America. So for 16,000 pounds, roughly $35,000, the king gave William Penn 45,000 square miles of land in what is now the state of Pennsylvania. Do the math. It's a very good deal. And but the whole thing about how Pennsylvania became the magnet for so many people, the Amish, the Mennonites, the Catholics, the Jews, because you could be any religion you wanted to be in Pennsylvania. And that was unique, and that's why Philadelphia became the largest city in North America very quickly. And by 1776, Philadelphia is the second largest English-speaking city in the world, behind London. And there it was. It peaked early, let's say, Philadelphia. But, you know, just today, or just this evening as I came here, I was just looking at the parkway, the sun. It was just gorgeous. We live in a gorgeous city, and I never get tired of that, of how beautiful the city of Philadelphia is and how proud it makes me to live here and call it my home, my hometown. And to be able to see it getting better all the time, to me, that's the way I feel. In my lifetime, Philadelphia has done nothing but get better. And of course, there are things that are wrong. Of course, there are things that, you know, the industry left, you know, things like that. But all in all, it's still a better city than it ever was when, let's say, we were all much younger. People can walk across the city without getting beat up. That's when I talk to some older guys, like that whole idea of like violence was, didn't have to be white or black, just, you know, you were a stranger. You get beat up. Who are you? Get out of here. You know why Pennsylvania is called the Keystone State? Because a keystone locks in an arch, right? Just by its own weight. And Pennsylvania locks in the 13 original colonies. There are 6 southern states below us, 6 northern states above us. And we're right in the middle. In fact, we're the only landlocked state of the 13 originals. Everyone else, every other state has an Atlantic coastline. So it's little things like that that I find fascinating, you know, especially because I should have known that a long time ago. I mean, why didn't I know that? I mean, we've all been calling ourselves the Keystone State. And who said, what's a keystone? Why are we called that? We discovered just 8 years ago, George Washington, well, the original White House, that George Washington and John Adams lived right across, you know, right where the Liberty Bell is. They were building the new Liberty Bell Center, and they said, oops, look at this, we found the original White House. They knew it had been there, but they didn't know it was still there, that the foundations were there. So when they're doing this archaeological dig, they discover slave quarters, where Washington had slaves when he was president of the United States, living in Philadelphia. This we didn't know. This came as a surprise to most of us, but Pennsylvania was the first state to outlaw slavery. This was in 1780. Washington's president in the 1790s. So how did he get away with it? Well, he was a politician, and it was a loophole. Pennsylvania law allowed you 6 months to move through the state with slaves. And if they were still here after 6 months, they were freed. So Washington waited 5 months and 3 weeks, sent his slaves back to Virginia or even into New Jersey just to break the continuity of it. And so the clock would start again. But he would rotate his slaves, much like we would rotate crops. So as I do when I'm doing tours, which I do, by the way, I do walking tours down in Independence area, right from the visitor center. But when I'm doing walking tours, I tell them, I don't want to tell you this about George Washington, but it's the truth. And it's a recently discovered truth or appreciated truth. 8 years ago, we didn't know this. Today, we know it. It's like what William Faulkner said. The past isn't dead. It isn't even past. And this is an example of something like it takes on a new significance, new information about something we thought we knew about. And, of course, you know, maybe you know the story about how African Americans, Philadelphians, rallied around this site, and they really lobbied, if that's the right word. But when I would see them there, like just crowds of people, hundreds of people around this construction site taking pieces of dirt and stone, you know, like it was a shrine. And because it was their ancestors. And the Park Service, with some reluctance, created this new exhibit a year ago. It opened called The President's House, A Story of Freedom and Slavery in the New Nation. Because not only do we know there were slaves, we know their names, we know what happened to them, we know the two of them ran away. They would have rather been free than work for the president. As I say, they were infected by freedom when they came north. Because they had never seen free blacks down in the plantations. Here were black people walking the streets and having businesses and selling stuff, and they went, whoa. And so two of them who ran away, one was Hercules, who was the cook, who was the chef. Actually, he was very well regarded. And the other was Oney Judge, who was Martha Washington's personal servant. And she ran away to New Hampshire. She got up there. And Washington sent slave hunters after her. That's another story. You know, it's like a stolen car. He wanted his property back. And the governor of New Hampshire actually saved or protected Oney Judge by saying he didn't know where she was. He lied. You know? And that just shows you how inextricably slavery has just wrapped itself around American history. And I'm proud that Pennsylvania was the first state to outlaw slavery. Things like this. These are little, in individual moments and in the aggregate, they add up to this. What a state, you know? That's why there have been 4 editions. I don't know how many states would have enough information for 4 editions. Let's see. So I knew some people had some questions here. Did you, Lois, have something you wanted to say? Okay, or an observation? Okay, sure. Oh, yeah, here you go. We have a microphone. So this is a podcast, by the way. Thank you, all the millions of people listening to this, watching this on podcast. Laura's telling me that actually there's a very big podcast audience out there for these events. So thank you.
Okay. Some of them are simply typos, so don't get nervous.
Oh, typos.
Don't get nervous.
Oh, my God.
However, page... There's no page number here. Near the beginning where you have descriptions of what words mean, like struble.
Oh, you mean the vocabulary?
At the top of the page, schmutz, a little kiss.
Schmutz,
for your information, schmutz is feces.
No, that's you're thinking, that's the Pennsylvania Dutch word? Schmutz is like what you get, like
where
it's
I come
a Yiddish word, right?
Schmutz is something you want to get far
away
from.
Let me say, no, that was an... what do you call it? Pennsylvania Dutch word. Let me see. It's a schmutz? No, I don't think that sounds right. Wutz. Wait a minute. Person who calls it. Anyway, the more popular ones are words like widges. Can I go widges down the shore? the young man who's manning the book table upstairs... He said, have you really heard someone say the word chimney? Oh, yes, I have. Yes. Chimney, you know, with a B sound. I don't know where it comes from. And where are we right today? We're this lovely building. We're in a library. Yeah. Which is a high-class place with books, let's say. Oh, Schuylkill. You know what the word Schuylkill means? Hidden river. It was... discovered, or was named by the Dutch. They were coming up the Delaware River exploring in the 1500s. They passed the mouth of the Schuylkill, not knowing it was a river because it was covered with reeds. It was like, I guess, a low tide, so they couldn't see the river. On their way back down, the tide had changed, so they could see it was a river. So that's where the name comes from. And just another thing, a Dutch name in a city or an area founded by the Swedes. That's our original European settlers were from Sweden. This area was known as New Sweden, like where Delaware, you know, Christiana, Delaware, that's named for Queen Christiana of Sweden. Same with Queen Villages, the old Swedish church right down there. There's so much, like, prehistory of in Philadelphia. In fact, literally, I was up at the Penn Treaty Park where William Penn made the treaty with the Indians. And there's an archaeologist who was showing me some of the artifacts they discovered. They're like 10,000 years old. 10,000, you know, where the Indians, natives, were. They had devices by which they would make a spear kind of heavier. It was like a rock that they would round the hole, and they put it on the back of the spear so it would give heft, you know, and then, you know, I guess it wasn't like a warrior weapon as much as killing deer or something like that. But these are things we find all the time in our city at you know, literally prehistoric. And you don't think of Philadelphia as being a great Indian haven, but it was because of its location, the river. Was there anything else you wanted to
add? I'm going to skip a couple just to save us both some embarrassment. Okay. Page 86, the cowboy.
In lieu of my mom, Lois here is helping me out.
You have to go by so fast, unless you have an accident. You can't really enjoy that. But if you go to the Borse building, they have postal cards of the cowboy for sale.
Yeah, I would love a postcard rather than seeing the cowboy. We're all familiar with the cowboy sculpture on East River Drive. I still call it that. It was the only life-sized Frederick Remington statue he ever did. It shows a rider on a horse, and he's pulling up at a precipice. He's pulling his horse back like this. Horse's tail is sticking out straight in the back. Frederick Remington actually picked that spot for the sculpture because it was perfect. And that was when East River Drive was like a carriage path. You know, you would go down at, you know, 10 miles an hour. Now, are you kidding me? You're trying to pull over there? Oh, let me look at the... Forget about it. Yeah. The Daily News just had a story about all the accidents along the East River Drive. Sir. Here you go. We got a microphone for you.
It's a Jeopardy kind of question. What city in Texas is named after a Philadelphia born and bred vice president and mayor?
Oh, throw me a tough one. That would be George Mifflin Dallas for 20. No, yeah, like Dallas was a mayor of Philadelphia, and he became the vice president under James Polk. And, you know, Texas was admitted to the Union during that time. So it made sense. But I love telling people from Dallas that. But actually, not only that, there's a DeLeon, Texas, a town with my last name. Who knew? Yeah. And in fact, when I went to San Antonio, I went to the Alamo, and there's a map of Revolutionary era Texas, the Texas Revolution, 1836. And there are like three colonies. There's the Austin colony, there's the Houston colony, and then there's the DeLeon colony. Where Victoria, Texas was a guy, obviously a Mexican, my name is Spanish, named DeLeon. And if anyone's here from Texas who knows anything about, every time I talk to somebody from Texas, nobody knows anything about it. But I was fascinated by it. Sir.
Can you say something about the statue of the Indian woman on the drive? I know the same sculptor did her and Ben Franklin in front of College Hall, Boyle or O'Boyle.
Which Franklin statue? There are a lot of them.
Franklin in front of College Hall.
In
the University of Pennsylvania.
University of Pennsylvania. The one where he's striding purposefully?
No.
Or the one where he's sitting on a bench?
Sitting.
Yeah, everyone loves that one. Yeah.
And that did the Indian woman on
where
the drive.
On
just to the left, about the half mile above the art museum.
Above the art museum.
Woman with she's holding a tomahawk and a baby. A tomahawk in the right hand, baby in the left hand.
Wow. I'm just not visualizing that. And I know most of those statues. You know the Viking statue?
Yeah.
All right. His name is Thorfinn Karlsefni. I can tell you that. He was Eric the Red's nephew. But the one you're talking about, with a tomahawk?
Wow. Yeah,
anyone
right.
else familiar with that statue? I'm kind of, I don't know that statue. I mean, maybe it's the way you're describing it. But let's talk about the one right here in front of the window, or outside here. The Swan Fountain, right? Right around Logan's, I call it Logan Circle. Now, it's funny how it was always Logan Circle. All of a sudden, people are calling it Logan Square. That fountain was the sculpture of the human figures and the other the frogs and the other animals in there is Alexander Sterling Calder, who was the son of Alexander Milne Calder, who did City Hall and the statue of William Penn on top. There are three human figures in that fountain. There's an Indian male, an Indian woman, and an Indian maiden. They represent the three rivers that flow into Philadelphia. The Delaware is the male, the Schuylkill is the woman, and the maiden is the Wissahickon. And that's the father and son of the Calders. There's a third, the grandson, Alexander Sandy Calder, has the mobile that is hanging in the Grand Court of the Philadelphia Museum of Art. It's called The Ghost. So when we speak of the Calder family, the generations of Calders in Philadelphia, we talk about the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. That's how you remember them. Yes, ma'am. Anyone see those orange flags up there by Eakins Oval today?
Yo, hello.
Yes,
this
hi.
This is Lit Person from the old AOL
chat room.
Hey, how
you doing, Regina?
Hi. And I want to get something straight.
Uh-oh.
And I think I gave the guy upstairs a hard time for the wrong reason, unfairly. When the book first came out, I saw you at Barnes & Noble that is now closed in Jenkintown on a Sunday when the Eagles were playing the Redskins, and I bought a copy of the book. And I got the impression from the write-up on the library website that this was like volume 4, a unique book from Volume 1, but is this actually an updated version?
There's a lot of new stuff. I would say half of this was never published before.
Okay, no, but what I'm saying is I was thinking, I'm going to have a gap in my collection. Not 2 and not 3, I just have 4 because they didn't bring 2 and 3 upstairs or even 1. So I thought...
I'm sure Amazon can help you out.
Now, what I'm saying is, though, but this is like the 2013 version of the book that first came out in 2001. Is that what this is more like?
Expanded and new stuff.
Yes.
I mean,
okay.
All kinds of stories, such as what I... Jessup, Pennsylvania, things like that. Mm-hmm. But from the first book, there's still in here because there's good stuff that people would never heard of before, such as... in Bradford County, up by, what's the name? Tawanda, Pennsylvania. There is a place called Asylum with a Z, and that was founded by French royalists in 1793. It was supposed to be where Marie Antoinette would find refuge during the Reign of Terror, or when they knew that the French monarchy was over, but so they were going to bring her to Pennsylvania, and they built this big, an estate, but a huge building that was going to be Marie Antoinette's home. And there's still a French colony up there. The place is called Asylum. It's now like a historic site more than anything, but the names are still in the community of these French people who came here, including Mitterrand. He was the vice president. He was the Dick Cheney of France. but so this is, again, like, who knew? This kind of a little wrinkle in history, and it all just flowed toward Pennsylvania. Here's one and I'm going to write about this next time, I think. Do you know the story of Robert Morris? You know, he was the richest man in America. He was the financier of the American Revolution. You know, out of his own pockets, he paid the salaries of soldiers to keep the Continental Army on the field. He was the treasurer. You know, he made the deals, he got the loans, everything. So in later life, in the 1790s, he ends up losing all his money in real estate. Have we heard that before, right? And it was because of the Napoleonic Wars. It just dried up all the cash, B, people's interest in buying land in Northwest, not Pennsylvania, like Ohio and Indiana, which was a real big, was going to be a boom area. So he gets put in debtor's prison. Here's a guy who saved the revolution, and he's put in prison right at 7th and Walnut Street for 3.5 years. He was in his 60s when they did this. You know who used to visit him in prison? George Washington. He'd have dinner with him. Didn't bail him out, but had dinner with him. And it became such an embarrassment to the Congress, to the country, this whole idea of debtor's prison is barbaric anyway. But so they changed the bankruptcy laws to allow him out of prison. But I'm still thinking, like, wow, here's a guy who did that. And it goes to show you, too. It's like if this happened to Donald Trump, let's say, we wouldn't be weeping for him. But that's the way that people felt about Robert Morris. So, yeah, he's too much. He had too much money. He was too wealthy. And so there was a little secret joy, what they call Schadenfreude. You know, they were happy. But then the idea of his accomplishments, he's one of two men to have signed all three founding documents, the Declaration, the Articles of Confederation, and the Constitution. I mean, he was there at the very beginning. He had a lot to do with our nation, and they put him in prison for 3.5 years. And he came out, he was, I guess, what you'd call the broken man. But what was really nice about that story, nice, I think, is his wife stood by him. His wife stood by him the entire time. She was the richest woman in the world at one point, and then she became basically a pauper. But she stood by her man, and when he came out, she was there. They had a little house where Jewelers Row is today. That was Robert Morris was building a big estate there, and they called it Morris's Folly because they called everything follies, you know, Fulton's Folly, Morris's Folly. But he lost a lot of money on that house, but not enough to bankrupt him. But that was right where his huge home was going to be, and he lost a lot of money on that. But, again, the history of the places we see every day. You take it for granted. You know, Philadelphia is a grid. It was the first planned city in America. William Penn laid it out in London. You know, this grid pattern, numbered streets, tree streets, oops. And because he had seen the Great Fire of London in 1666, which destroyed 87,000 buildings. And he was determined that Philadelphia would not meet the same fate. That's why the streets are the way they are. If you look at Arch Street, for instance, which is actually Mulberry Street, they named it, it was Mulberry Street, then it became Arch Street because they built a bridge over it. It became the street with the arch. Same way Sassafras Street today is called Race Street because that was the drag strip on the edge of town where young Philadelphians went to race their horses and wagons. Mothers would warn their sons, don't go to the race street, but they did. And of course, South Street was Cedar. So I have a map at home from 1852. It shows those, you know, shows Philadelphia. And it shows South or Cedar, Sassafras or Race, Mulberry or Arch. But the thing I love the most is, you know, there used to be a Schuylkill Front Street and a Schuylkill Second Street and a Schuylkill Third and it met like at Broad Street. It was where 15th Street is, that was Schuylkill 8th. And it was in 1854 when the city consolidated, the city and county consolidated, that's when the names became standardized, you know. Market Street, once you went into West Philadelphia, Market Street became Andrew Street. There were so many streets that just changed names because they were going out of jurisdiction. It was Philadelphia, then they would go into Northern Liberties, then in other like Kensington, Richmond, all these were different municipalities. So that's this map of 1852 is really fun to just look at and see all the changes and also to see what's still the same. Like Eastern State Penitentiary, it's unbelievable. They had running water there and before the President of the United States in the White House. Literally, they had hot water and cold water. It was an engineering marvel. And it was the first penitentiary because they had a new, it was a Quaker thing. The Quakers believed that prisons, just putting a guy in jail didn't work. You got to make him feel penitent. He has to be sorry to God, not, you know, to anyone else. But in the eyes of God, they must express their penitence. So the way the Quakers figured out was put them in solitary confinement for their entire time. You know, what this did, of course, is drive them crazy. But this was actually the way that was seen as beneficial or kinder than the old system. If you came into Eastern State Penitentiary, they put a hood over your head. And you never saw another human being for the rest of your time in prison. That wasn't easy to do either. The guards used to slide food in under these trays of food silently, never talked. They would wear socks or cloth over their shoes as not to make noise so that the inmates would never know, there was a human being outside. Think of what that played on your head, you know. In fact, Charles Dickens, when he visited Philadelphia in 1842, he said he wanted to see two things in America. He wanted to see Niagara Falls and Eastern State Penitentiary. And his comments on Eastern State were spot on. He said, there's something very disturbing about this, what they're doing to the mind of a man, you know, putting him in this situation. I think it's somehow, we'll see by history will prove whether or not it's really a bad thing. And it probably would have proved it, but it became, the prison just got too crowded. There was no cells for solitary, so they started doubling up guys. And then you had, you know, when that prison stopped, it opened in 1820 and it operated until 1971. Imagine that. I mean, that's, I had a friend of mine who lived out there in Fairmount, and his father happened to be a guest of Eastern State. And on his way to school, he'd see his father in one of those black and white striped, you know, prison suits. They would be doing some kind of cleaning up, you know, the city where there was a show. But I'm just saying, my friend, and it's like, that must be a real sensation, seeing your dad, you know, in a prison suit with the guards around, and you're on your way to school. hey, Dad, hey. No, I don't think so. But things like that. Eastern State was the model prison for 300 prisons in the world are designed on the model of Eastern State. They were the first ones to come up with the rotating spokes of cell blocks from a central rotunda so that one guard or two guards could be taken, you could see everything. You know, mischief wouldn't be involved. So the 300 prisons worldwide are based on that. And as I said, it had running water before the White House. Has anyone read any of the other books? I always sort of give credit to the idea of Pennsylvania, because I think what we in Pennsylvania aren't necessarily appreciative of, that the landscape has been raped over and over and over again. You know, it started with lumber. They denuded, they would cut down all the trees. Literally, there was mountains in western Pennsylvania. I've seen pictures. They're just like brown, like humps and no trees. That's why we got our state forest system was based on the abandoned land left from the loggers tearing down all the trees. What are you going to do? So the state came in and took it over and started planting trees. And, you know, it was out of desperation and, you know, to protect the soil and things like that. Then you had, of course, coal with the tearing up, digging the coal and then strip mining it. And abusing human beings in the work that they did. The anthracite coal mines were awful. Then there's oil. Oil struck in western Pennsylvania. I've seen pictures there where they have derricks, wooden derricks, springing up like trees. I mean, almost comical. You know, like 100 oil derricks on a slanted slope because they just kept trying to drill for oil. In Bradford County, there's Bradford, Pennsylvania, and then there's Bradford County. In the Bradford, which is out there in McKean County, there are 90,000 oil wells in Pennsylvania, in that area. 90,000. This is why we should all be thinking about fracking and what's going to happen, because this is just the newest, all right? We're going to crush the shale underneath us, and we're going to... And what's funny, in a way, is that it's only because it's so deep. That's what separates the natural gas thing from the oil thing. But Pennsylvania oil was considered, they called it the miracle molecule, because Pennsylvania oil was green instead of black. It was kind of tea green. And it was great, like Quaker State. You know, all this was the best motor oil. And the way they got this oil out of the ground, you always think of gushers and all in an oil well. In Pennsylvania, they would drill down till they hit what they called oil shale, which was, who knows how thick, but it was a section. They would drill through it, and once they hit the oil shale, then they continued down till they hit bedrock again. Then they knew how large that slice of oil shale was. Then they would load it with nitroglycerin, and they'd send it down there, and they had this like a metal, like a shuttlecock kind of thing. It was made of steel. They called it a devil, and they would drop it down into the shaft, which is, let's say, 2,000 feet, and then kablooey, it would blow up, creating a big hole. Not like an explosion hole, but in the shale, it would create a rupture. And then the weight of the earth, literally, would squeeze the oil into this, like a pool, into this hole that was underground, and they would start pumping it up. That's how Pennsylvania got its coal. Out there in the Bradford oil area, I went to an oil museum out there, and the old guy at the who ran it was telling me how they had these nitroglycerin trucks. They were either horse-drawn in the old days, and then they became like, a pickup truck with nitroglycerin. And every now and then, there was an accident, and, when nitro goes off, you got a gallon of nitro, there's not much left of the mule, of the man, of anything. So in this little town of Custer out there near Bradford, They blew out all the windows of the school. But then the kids, this is really strange, the kids would be hired to go look for body parts, like, you know, flesh that was just obliterated, hanging on trees, wherever. And they got a nickel for every remain they brought back. Think of this. I mean, that's what a... Wouldn't you like to send your kids out to do something like that? So, I mean, that's another story of, like, when we think our childhood was one way or tough, and you compare it to the way coal miners' kids, like the little boy 7 years old working in a mine 12 hours a day, opening and closing the door. That's all he did. Open and close, so let the mules come in. And the mules never saw daylight. Once they were down there, they worked until they died. So what we consider humane was non-existent. And Philadelphia led the way in humanity for animals. I don't know. In the old city, you'll see these fountains that are everywhere that from the Fountain Society of Philadelphia. And some of them are still hooked up, but they are water fountains for horses and dogs. The horses drank from the outside one. Many of them are now planters. And then the dogs from the inside one. And it said, there's one outside of Pennsylvania Hospital that says, a merciful man is merciful to his beast. And there was a working fountain right on the south side of Washington Square. One time I was doing a tour showing people around. I was on a bus, and we got stopped. It was like a traffic jam. There's a horse getting a drink. But the horse came perpendicular to the fountain, so you couldn't get past. It was very amusing. And that was a Philadelphia traffic jam. So, any other questions, observations? Oh, look, sir,
I understand that I've heard. In Bradford, Pennsylvania, they grow the world's biggest tomatoes.
Unbelievable.
Did you discover anything that confirmed or debunked that?
I actually have a picture of that. There's a guy here named Larry Rotherain, who, there he is on page... It's 271. This is a tomato plant, the cherry tomatoes. He has the biggest yields of vegetables. Unbelievable. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of cherry tomatoes from one plant, and regular tomatoes and everything else. And he's part of a thing called biodynamic gardening, and it's kind of a astral projection. He believes in star power and compost, essentially. That was the two big things. Yeah. But his vegetables are so good, and I've eaten them. They're the best, really. I mean, you know, you have a tomato, what we call tomatoes, that are, you know, you cut it open, and it's got that kind of watery insides with the little tendons or whatever holding it. His are like big, they're like textured of, when they're filled with just no juice. It's all just delicious tomato and really, really quality. And there he is. He's a guy from Philadelphia, went to Northeast High. He was a quarterback of the Northeast football team, and he got involved in this biodynamic gardening. He provides vegetables for a five-star resort out there. So these are the kind of things, you know, just discovering these kinds of stories, getting lucky, like walking into the Flight 93 place. Oh, yeah, then. So that was on Friday night. On Saturday, we go to Flight 93, and it was a miserable day. But there were a lot of people. It was rainy, miserable, but there were maybe 50 people there. And the guy who was a volunteer, and he's wearing a uniform of the park, he was showing how the plane, he's holding up a little model of the plane, and showed how the hijackers tried to took the plane up to 10,000 and then lowered it, you know, tried to throw the passengers off, to rock the plane back and forth so that when the passengers started their revolt. Then I asked him again, it was just like something about that day. He says, I was not a first responder, I was there the second day. And he was there, his job was to canvas the crash site for anything, you know, like something, you know, bits of evidence. So he's walking, he said, I'm a big, and it was nothing but shards of just destroyed trees and stuff. And he said, I'm not really the most agile guy. And I took two steps and I fell down, and he falls on like his hands. And I'm thinking he's going to tell me he got a stake through it. But he says, and I landed next to this tree, and I looked, and in it, embedded in the bark, was a credit card. The credit card was in Arabic. He calls over an FBI guy, says, I found something. And it was only when he read the report later that he realized he had found the credit card where they had, the hijackers had bought their airline tickets. That was the beginning of the money trail. But, you know, what are the odds? As I've said, a first responder, mother of the daughter of the oldest passenger, and then this guy. So sometimes you get lucky, and sometimes it was just meant to be. How are we doing? Good? Okay. Hey, thanks a lot, everybody. I appreciate it. Thank you. Great. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.